Hello and welcome to the first episode of To Fintech and Beyond, a new podcast brought to you by Tribe. Together with a series of experts, we're going to be covering all things open banking, cross-border payments, and much, much more. I'm Alex Reddish, MD at Tribe, and for those of you that don't know much about Tribe, we're an infrastructure provider focusing on both the issuing and the acquiring side of the transaction. We cover all things acceptance, initiation, open banking, and real-time payments within one single set of APIs. You can find us at tribepayments.com. Keep up to date with our latest news on Twitter and LinkedIn. And yeah, joining us today for our first episode is Connor Gill from B, Shaping the Future, and we'll be covering embedded finance and banking as a service. Welcome to the launch of Tribe's podcast, To Fintech and Beyond. I think, you know, the plan here is to ask those tough questions, tackle the big challenges, payments and fintech. Each episode, we're going to try and focus on a single bold question we'll pose to our guest speakers. We'll be touching on hot topics such as crypto, open banking, cross-border payments, and much, much more. Today, I have the delight of welcoming Connor here. We're going to discuss the difference between embedded finance, BaaS. Does it matter? Do we really care? So Connor, I guess starting with you, it'd be great to have a bit of a background on you and the business. And yeah, we'll start there, I think.
Thanks for inviting me on, Alex. So yeah, I'm Connor Gill. I'm a partner at a management consultancy firm called B Shaping the Future UK. So for those who haven't heard of B Shaping the Future, it is an Italian business originally. So we're still the mothership, still in Italy. We're floated on the Italian Stock Exchange, but we've operations in 13 different markets now across Europe. So a fairly kind of pan-regional business. The business itself focuses on retail and commercial banking, capital markets, risk and finance, and cards and payments. And I'm the head of the cards and payments practice in the UK.
You should be the expert for this then.
Well, I've got a pretty extensive background in cards and payments. So I've been at B for 2 years. Prior to that, I spent 10 years at a strategy consultant firm with a focus on payments as well called Epidon Company. And across my career, I've worked throughout the entire ecosystem in payments. So issuers, acquirers, issuer acquirer processors, PSP, PayFac, card schemes. So I've done quite a bit with international card schemes, domestic card schemes. I helped set up two of those, one in Turkey called Troy, another one in Egypt called Mitsa. Worked with travel firms, so OTAs, IATA, International Air Travel Association. I've worked with regulators. I've worked with private equity firms as well who are investing in what effectively are now fintechs. So more than infrastructure as a layer type fintechs, the enablers. But yeah, so pretty extensive experience, and not just in the UK, but across EMEA as well. That's my geographic scope.
Wonderful. We wanted to start with a kind of a scene setter, I guess, focusing on sort of expectation from both consumers and businesses in terms of what do they expect from a financial service provider today? I guess the subcontext of that question is also, you know, who is the financial service provider today? So I think maybe we could start there and then we'll see where it takes us.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think expectations are always a bit of a mixed bag, right? And I think when you look at the what consumers and businesses, let's just say the two kind of major groups, what they would have expected from financial service providers, say even 10, 12 years ago, is very different. The financial services products and services that they were offered and the manner in which they were offered them as well, right, was pretty static and not very innovative. So I think now consumers are becoming much more aware of the increasing range of options that they have in the market, both in terms of products and services, but also how they can access those products and services. The caveat to that is that there are varying levels of awareness dependent upon which consumer segment you look at. Then you look at businesses, again, but not as far along, I think, in that developmental curve. They've been underserved quite some time, right, by financial services providers. I think that's pretty clear. But again, it's a segmentation argument there, right? So SMEs have been, and probably still are, quite underserved. But there are now lots of new different fintech kind of business models, fintech businesses that are selling products and services to SMEs or SMBs. And they're addressing specific pain points that they have, whether that's kind of cross-border payments like Airwallex or other kind of accounting or back office pain problems, so like Form 3, for example. And then you get the larger enterprise-grade businesses, so who are kind of targeting SaaS marketplace solutions into different types of enterprise grade businesses. So that's your Stripe, Adyen's, Checkout.com. So I think it's, yeah, it's very much a mixed bag, but that's all changing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think some of it comes from the expectation, whether you're a merchant, corporate or consumer, I guess, around the experience, around how you access the product? Like, obviously it's very easy to say digitalization, right? But I think there seems to be a big push towards the experience side of how we interact with financial services these days, not just a transaction.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the experience has definitely changed. How it's been delivered has changed. I mean, I don't want to kind of belabor the point, but the range of products and services has changed, but also, yeah, of course, the delivery of that. And if you look back to when this current iteration of fintech started, probably 10 years ago, and we can see since then very clearly the benefits that have been delivered or engendered by digital-first business models. I think that's quite clear.
Yeah.
And it's always through a customer-centric value proposition that's much improved. I think the major changes that are coming now are around stratification and diversification. So stratification, that's basically new business models, fintech business models that are being launched, new target segments, additional vertical coverage. And then when you look at diversification, you see that the range of products and services available are becoming kind of more abundant. So if you think about Revolut, when they started out with their kind of cross-border pain point alleviation that was targeted specifically at millennials, well, they've now moved out. They have a much broader range of products. So they're not only doing a broader range of cards, savings products, additional kind of credit products, they're doing crypto, they're doing investment products. So they've basically diversified a lot of their product offering. And then in the kind of smaller revenue scale perspective, you see other fintechs that are targeting specific niches. So, and that's a really strong value proposition for that niche. So business like GoHenry, for example, is targeting the youth market, and they've kind of focused on that and they're doing that very well. So you mentioned kind of user experience overall. I think that's one of the major changes, right? It's around user interfaces that are slicker, user experience that's kind of more comprehensive and better thought through from the entire kind of the customer journey, the whole kind of life cycle of that. And that's because basically fintechs realized, right, that was a key battleground with incumbents. It's something they didn't do well, something that they could improve. And that's at the kind of fintech application layer. I think then when you look at the enabler layer, so enablers as in the infrastructure as a service providers that sit kind of below them and provide the power, so such as Stripe payments and a lot of issuer processors as well. I think the improvements in the product offering and the services offering from enablers has basically facilitated quite a lot of the end user benefits as well.
Yeah, I think it comes down a bit. Thank you for the mention. I was determined not to try and sell our products in these podcasts. If our guests mention it, that's okay. I think the other thing that comes from that is then that hyper-personalization, right? The need now, the digital first attitude ultimately, and this sort of infrastructure layer allows for a personalized experience. And I think you talk about Revolut, it's almost the unbundling and rebundling of fintech in the sense that they kind of found their niches and then aggregated those value propositions back together into this, let's call it a super app, because that's the terminology that everyone uses. It feels like, I mean, you know, my father-in-law loves his Revolut card, probably uses it more than an incumbent bank. And I think the value for him is the personalization, the understanding of what he's doing. You know, he gets his offers, he gets his notification of spends. And I think that sort of marked improvement in the sort of data centricity and the delivery of that value to the customer is kind of where as you say, the battleground where fintechs kind of made a stance. But yeah, interesting space. We're supposed to be talking about embedded finance and BaaS, right? Yeah. So I think perhaps maybe I should start by asking for a definition of embedded finance and trying to understand it, like, because in my view, frankly, it's not a new phenomenon, right? We've just renamed it, but let's see what you have to say about it.
Yeah, so I think with embedded finance and banking as a service, the first thing they say is they're both relatively new into the market. So there's no common definition of both, right? It's very much still for grabs in terms of having a nailed down, commonly agreed definition. And actually, we used to joke in some projects we've been working on recently that if you ask 10 people what embedded finance and bank as a service were, you'll get 8 different answers. I think what we started saying is, if you ask the same person 3 days in a row, you'll get 3 different answers. I get that. Yeah, so it's, so when I define these, it's basically very much my take on it, right? And how I kind of see the market. So it's still up for discussion. I think there's a conversation ongoing very much in the industry about this. And in terms of defining embedded finance, I think it's probably important first to define banking as a service before embedded finance, because ultimately I would define embedded finance against banking as a service, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So banking as a service to me is the provision of and the distribution of, critically, using a white label model, banking services, but in which a core banking or a bank account provision is central to the overall proposition. So we refer to that as core banking, basically. So core banking consists of account provision, general ledger, customer management, ability reporting, IBAN services. Also, you could probably put some product modeling in there. And I think in the BaaS go-to-market model, you have a number of different key players. And this is on the issuing side. If you, I try to think of it as well differently from the issuing side as on the acceptance side, because I think they're very much different beasts, right? But you can draw similarities between the two. And I think you have the banking provider, you have the BaaS provider or platform, you have the fintech distributor, which can be optional. It's not always a key element, but it's optional. Then you have the BaaS customer and ultimately an end user. Now, with bank and BaaS providers, they can be the same. So, for example, with the Solaris Bank, or they can be separate brands, for example, like Ion and Vidino, but they're under common ownership. And I think critically here, the services that they offer, that the BaaS provider offers, is often determined by the licensing status. So whether or not you have a full banking license or whether you've got an EMI license, that can determine the level of services you can offer on a proprietary basis. In terms of like what they can offer, I think within BaaS, there's some key elements from the BaaS kind of value chain, and they're all different enabler categories. And there's all basically an aggregation of different enabler categories. So it's core banking, I just mentioned, BIN sponsorship, issuer processing, some form of compliance and risk, some form of program management, and then some additional bolt-ons and potentially around user interface or open banking provision. But yeah, what we see critically is these different enabler capabilities or functionalities are provided on either a white label or proprietary basis, and then sold or resold to either financial services or non-financial services customers.
Yeah, I think the sort of nature of BaaS seems to be the sort of aggregation or evolution of what we saw as sort of FinTech 1.0 in terms of these delivery now of a payment account, the ability to move transactional data, IBANs, sort code and account numbers, you know, like you've referenced open banking, I'd say that's a sort of 2-3 year incremental inclusion. But
yeah,
what do you think presents challenges to that model, or I guess what are the opportunities to be both positive and negative? Like, where does it go? What are its risks?
I think we'll basically see more players coming into the market because it's still in its infancy. I think some people are there now and we're doing it well. But I think we'll see more of a rollout of different players coming into the market, and then they'll basically own more of that value chain. So it's about kind of filling in those gaps on a proprietary basis, because at the minute, nobody does it 100% on a proprietary basis. So Solaris Bank, Waze Bank, that they know, they all basically get services from elsewhere. They've got some proprietary capabilities in there. But as they do that, obviously revenues will increase, profitability will increase. And I think the kind of number of use cases that they target then will increase. And I think we'll just see more of a proliferation of it in the market.
And do you think this, maybe it's not, but do you think this is a European answer, or do you think the sort of globalization of BaaS is on the same track? Like, you know, if we take MENA, for example, does it move in the same trajectory, or, you know, does geographical variation come into play?
So BaaS, as it stands, in terms of how I understand it, in terms of maturity, is more a European phenomenon. And that's because I think passport and rights within the European Union have basically facilitated a better business model for BaaS providers, right? So basically you can operate across EU27 with a banking license from Germany. And that is really beneficial in terms of finding your market when the market's still kind of being made. You don't really have that level of kind of pan-regional regulatory cohesion outside of Europe. So it's much more difficult to do it on a market-by-market basis or on a pan-regional basis, because obviously you have to have banking licenses then in every market or banking relationships. And doing that from a ground-up, a bottom-up perspective is quite a difficult thing to do. So it's very much a regional story at the minute, I think.
So actually, the regulatory landscape and the open access that were provided by payment service directives, e-money directives, are the catalysts for some of this innovation ultimately.
Yeah, definitely. It's slightly different, I would say, on the acceptance side, because on the acceptance side, you see the PayFac model, I think, is fairly equivalent to the kind of BaaS provider model on the issued side. So basically, it's the same thing. So the white-labeled provision of merchant accounts and then the distribution of those merchant accounts, acquire processing, access to BIN infrastructure, user interface, etc. So if you look at the PayFac model, you could make an argument that it is a quasi kind of BaaS provider, or a proxy BaaS provider on the acceptance side. And now the span and the relationships, the acquiring relationships that PayFac providers have on a pan-regional basis or multi-regional basis, then that's probably closer to a kind of more international cross-border play outside of Europe that you're going to see. But that's where kind of nowhere near that, I think, on the Asian side.
Yeah, we're talking in a few weeks to Currency Cloud on this podcast about sort of globalization and still making it local. I think the BaaS product on the acceptance side is much more focused on localization, payments acceptance, the different APMs that are required. I think the beauty of the initiation, or let's call it issuing side, I guess, for the context, is ubiquity is relatively easy to come by, right? It's just a regulatory landscape that prohibits it. But
exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting, I think, like, to look at BaaS on the acquiring side. It's not a very talked about subject, is it? So
yeah,
I like that parallel, actually. So well, I'm learning today, at least. do you think going to embedded finance a little bit more, obviously we're starting to see people, as you said earlier, kind of enable non-financial service providers to accept financial service products, or ultimately engage in the financial service process, you know, deliver a seamless experience, you know, all of that sort of stuff. Do you think, and I think, sorry, to add to that, you were talking about people moving down the value chain and stuff like that. Like, do you think, therefore, there are new opportunities to come from the creation of embedded finance? Do you think it creates new markets, new propositions, or do you think it's just as simple as, you know, giving some non-payments people some payments products?
So embedded finance, I think it's very much with the foothills of embedded finance. It's, I think, the business model and the value proposition on the issuing side particularly is fairly nascent. Even finding examples of successful embedded finance businesses is, I mean, the examples are more limited, let's just say that, than there is in the BaaS side. So I think the market will kind of work through and it will be an opportunity. But I think it's still kind of, the market's still figuring out exactly what it's supposed to be. And I think even getting a common definition of that is, I think, more difficult for embedded finance than it is for BaaS. Because for me, it's very much more of and you mentioned to non-financial, non-FI clients, but I think for embedded finance, it's as much about providing embedded finance products to financial services companies already, as well as non-financial services companies. I think it's a kind of dual market in many ways.
It's a lazy assumption on my side, I guess, but everyone needs ultimately that acceptance model or that sort of productization.
I think that's, so it's just different use cases who you're selling to, right? But I think the key thing for me is it's definitely about service aggregation. There's less provision on a proprietary basis. Proprietary basis is a lot of white labeling going on. And I think it's about the single contract as well. Structure with the customer, kind of owning that entire customer relationship. And then you're just basically acting as a pass-through to a certain extent. I mean, that's probably a gross over-exaggeration or a gross simplification.
I think I remember being asked it by Bain a few years ago, and we always used to reference Squires in the US, the sort of barbershop provider. That, and I think that the reason I always like that example was that actually embedded finance talks to a lot more than just the finance piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. It's actually about how you integrate, you know, how do you rent out the chair? How do you allocate salaries? How do you allocate cost? All of the data layers that sit within that, I think, you know, it's just smart acceptance, right? That is much more than just a 16-digit PAN and an auth and a clearing message. There's real data value around it.
Yeah. And you look at the kind of some of the key characteristics around what they do now. So it's always quick and frictionless, like no code, drag and drop applications, RESTful APIs. And it's all around the integration, kind of quick and easy integration into the customer's application, as it were. And that's, again, I think you can differentiate here between the issuing and the acceptance side, right? On the acceptance side, you see more mature business models. And the value propositions, I think, a lot clearer. And you see more on the issuing side is very much, I think, as it stands, kind of pretty much a card-orientated business so far. There is, on the acceptance side, I think, a clear kind of examples of credit and kind of loan facilities being used. So buy now, pay later, of course, is a very clear kind of example. And it's that business model is well established and everyone kind of knows how it works. But then I've seen some other interesting ones like merchant cash advances, so offered by businesses such as Libris, for example. And that's a really interesting kind of embedded finance play as well, right? And really interesting actually the whole kind of repayment model and stuff. It's quite good.
I think the merchant cash advance is such a smart model in the sense that you're fundamentally de-risked by only the acquiring flow, right? You've always got first right of refusal. So
exactly, yeah.
I think it's an interesting, like you mentioned that on the issuing side, it's relatively card-based. Like if we look at what open banking was becoming, it became that sort of open finance and everyone assumes it becomes the open life, right? We love a sort of a pipe dream in payments. But what is embedded finance evolve into? You say it's card-based now. What do you think it looks like in 3 to 5 to 10 years?
That's a good question.
and what are the lottery numbers for the weekend at the same time?
So I can't tell you what I think it's going to be because it's basically a tough call. I can tell you what I think I would like it to look like, and that's very much what particularly in the issuing side. So what I think would be great would be if it evolved into kind of quasi marketplace platform, an embedded finance platform that was effectively a digital marketplace for different applications. So they're all the kind of hallmarks of the current tech, so quick and easy, frictionless integration, but then connected to a huge number of financial services providers and products on one side, and then that you're connecting the many on that side to the many kind of consumers and businesses on the other side. So if you imagine, for example, a huge kind of multinational corporate who provided their employees with phones, and those phones had a digital kind of application marketplace in it. And they could basically then access provision a card, payment cards, unsecured loans, secured loans, mortgages, insurance, personal financial management tools, crypto exchanges, for example, investment, open banking solutions, all the rest of it. You mentioned that before. So imagine they could access all those, but then had different profiles for personal and professional products. And I think that would be pretty incredible. And that's not even all the potentialities that could be derived from that. I'm sure there are lots more different applications for it.
Yeah. And I think it's we finally established the value of partnership, right? Like we're never going to win this on our own, but actually the marketplace is an aggregation of niche value through individual companies or products. And I think you're right. Like it's what Starling did a bit on the consumer side with some of their aggregation of their sort of pension B models and stuff like that, right? And I think we'll definitely see it on the corporate side just because we're still individual people that work for a corporate that expect a good service. Just because we put corporate in front of their name doesn't remove the human emotional nature from the decision making. Do you think there are things that influence the reshaping of the industry as such? So regulation, digital currency, do you think there's anything around that that kind of forces our hand in terms of innovation or trajectory?
Regulation is always a factor, right? So you can't kind of underplay how important regulation is. But I mean, in Europe, you get a pretty good idea of what's coming down the pipeline in terms of regulatory, new pieces of regulation that's going to impact the banking market, going to impact the kind of payments industry. So you have a good amount of time to kind of see what's coming and then be able to kind of react, as it were. I think there are a lot of other question marks around digital currencies and crypto. So what exactly do we mean when we talk about crypto? It's a million different things to a lot of different people. At the minute, it's still basically an investment asset, a pretty bad investment asset if you can look at the news.
Yeah, this week, definitely.
And then I think you look at the difficulties that some of the crypto payment systems have had in terms of trying to get off the ground. So the one that springs to mind, DM, and that struggled, of course, and it had quite a significant amount of backing in terms of experienced e-commerce businesses sitting behind it, or who were involved in it in the early stages of its development, I should say. They weren't behind it the whole time. But I think when you try and introduce, as a regulator, when you try and introduce a concept to a regulator who is, by definition, the regulator of a central bank, which is the definition of centralization, when you try to introduce a decentralized payment system into their jurisdiction, then that's going to cause panic, right? And especially when it could be used across different social media platforms, because ultimately any kind of cross-border, unmonitored payment system is an AML, KYC, complete disaster. So getting those types of payment systems off the ground, and you have to have a payment system, first of all, right, before you can have the actual crypto currency that operates within that system. So I think we're a long way off having any successful fully functional operating use cases of cryptos. I think the closest we're going to come within the foreseeable future will be CBDCs and stable coins that are basically third-party owned but are pretty low risk and very closely regulated. So in terms of how they might impact BaaS and embedded finance, I mean, I think we're still a long way off that. It's probably looking too far down the line to be able to give any kind of level of accuracy in terms of outcomes. But yeah, it's interesting. I think everyone's keeping an eye on it. But people, I think, are very concerned about crypto and open banking, for example. Yeah. And open banking is another one. It's how successful has that been? I think that's a bit of a question in the market recently. And I think it has huge potential, but is there the demand there for it? And you even have this with some banking as a service kind of commentators at the minute. They're saying, is there that much of a demand for it? Has it really taken off as much as they thought? But I think the reality is that the regulatory infrastructure is in place for to support basically the rollout and the development of banking as a service and embedded finance, at least in Europe, right, on a kind of cross-border basis. But we don't see that as much for crypto. And then we have seen it for open banking, but the demand wasn't there. So, I went around the houses answering that question.
No, it's interesting. I think, like, I've just speaking of DM, I see David Marcus has come out to say that he's building a new blockchain-based business on the Lightning Network this morning. So,
okay,
still working hard at it, I think.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you're right around asset classes. I think people, you see the taxation stuff coming over in the US at the moment. And I think people are going to be found with some pretty hefty bills where, you know, tax years have ended and the arse has fallen out of the crypto market and all of a sudden they're left with a tax bill and no crypto to sell. I think it's going to be a challenging time for the space. But I think conversely, you don't really see anyone leaving the crypto space. Anyone that moves into Web3 seems to love it, dive into it and kind of stay there. So they must be doing something right.
Well, there's still a lot of investment in that space, right? And I think because it's not fairly well understood and the whole kind of business model yet from if you think about it, right, so from an investment asset kind of class perspective, then I think doing your own kind of ICO and getting that out there and getting an initial kind of load of revenue, as it were, kind of generated for your business, then that's a pretty positive business case. But sustaining that over the long term, that's where the trouble sets in. But then in terms of the infrastructure as a service, the fintech layer that kind of supports all of those different cryptocurrencies. And don't forget, a big element of crypto at the minute And where fintechs have had a lot of success is in the actual conversion of cryptocurrency to fiat currency. So the likes of crypto.com, Coinbase, they're kind of Anchorage Bank as well in the US. They're kind of the deal that they have with Visa. Those businesses are all kind of doing well from a particularly in cards and payments space, because they're basically providing a conversion of when people cash out from the crypto space, the crypto exchange, into a fiat wallet, then that's basically converting that currency, then that cryptocurrency into fiat currency, but it's in the card rails. And there's still quite a lot of investment in that, because people are ultimately, when they don't have the ability to actually cash out or de-ramp, ramp off, as you say, in paying crypto at a POS terminal, then you still need the fiat currency equivalent, right? So so those business models are doing fairly well. And Anchorage Bank as well in the US. So they've got a deal with, I think it's crypto.com and Visa, where crypto.com can settle a certain percentage of their settlement obligation to Visa in, I think it's Ethereum. And then Anchorage Bank is a digital fiat settlement.
That's interesting.
Bank. Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah, I think the crypto space is an interesting evolutionary option for BaaS, right? Like, we talked about BaaS as a product being value based, the ledger. Like, how do you ultimately? It's then for the aggregation of assets, whether they be digital fiat, you know, crypto or whatever. I think there's an opportunity for the aggregation. I think as the market starts to come around to it being more than an asset class, but I think. Adoption, and we were sort of talking about this on a blog the other day, like the adoption of crypto is fundamentally defined by simplicity. And at the moment, there's thousands of products, multiple ones that could hurt you or scam you. There's multiple variations in, you know, productization. It's just a bit of a misnomer or unknown.
Yeah, it's the Wild West at the minute, right? Everyone's going in for a land grab. There's a lot of skullduggery going on in there. Let's just say,
yeah, exactly. Okay, so we're trying to ask everyone that comes on this podcast one question that's always the same, so we can try and get some interesting variation in answers. So you're the first person to answer this, so you've got no pressure. There's never been a previous answer to compete against, but we're kind of just trying to work through, like, what is the one thing in fintech that you think is yet to happen?
Oh, that's a good question. Do we have to just stick to one thing?
I'll give you two. You can set the rules because you're the first one to respond, so everyone else will have to fall in line.
Well, I'll set the precedent then and say, come up with as many different answers as I can. So I think in fintech, we haven't seen yet consolidation to the level that we're probably going to see. I mean, we've seen some, so we've seen SaltPay acquire Tatuka and acquire Paymentology. There's been a few other places, Solaris Bank and Qantas. Yep. There has been some consolidation. I think we're going to probably see a lot more of that. And then it's the second thing I think then that would lead to would be on the acquiring side and the acceptance side, you see very much kind of integrated service providers. So the likes of Stripe and Adyen, basically, who've got, they cover a lot of the value chain, if not the whole value chain on the acceptance side, right? So that's when we can operate PayFac and acquiring model. So I think we haven't seen that same level of kind of integrated service provision on the issuing side. So I think if you, for example, if you developed a kind of cloud native core banking solution, so like a Mongo Thought Machine 10X kind of platform, that had an integrated issuer acquire processor into it, that had BIN sponsorship capabilities, and had a really slick kind of user interface, all the rest, KYC and kind of onboarding tools, then I think you would have a pretty solid value proposition on. But we haven't kind of seen that same level of service aggregation from a proprietary and kind of, when I say proprietary, I mean they've got all their own licensing capabilities, but they've also developed all their own tech and their own kind of system, a cohesive, kind of comprehensive platform. I think in fintech, we haven't seen fintech for good, really. It's been bubbling under the surface. I think I'd like to see a lot more of that because there's a lot of potential there. I've heard a lot of good work has been done in the space on financial inclusion, but I'd just basically like to see more business models spring up that are particularly predicated on that. That pain point.
That's a nice note. I think on the first point, I think those that built war chests last year are in a, it's going to be a very interesting time for M&A over the next 12, 24 months, you know.
Yeah.
New bank strike. Like, I think there's that complexity of everyone that raised at a high valuation and now can't deliver the revenues. There'll be some low-hanging fruit for some of this M&A. And I think you're right. Like, what you find is then that people move up and down the value chain. Yesterday announcing that they'd bought other companies in terms of digital KYC and things like that. I think we're going to see a lot of that, and those that overextended themselves in this boom are going to find it tough, I think. But I think for good is a nice way to finish, you know, like environmental change as well as financial inclusion. I think fintech has a great opportunity to sort of challenge and foster.
Yeah, we've seen some good announcements around that recently, right? So I think it was Stripe, Meta, Alphabet, was it, and McKinsey has a frontier. Initiative called Frontier, which is basically a carbon buyback proposition. I think we'll see more of that, but then also on the kind of smaller scale as well, fintechs that are just specifically there to increase financial inclusion, for example, and get more people involved in the formal economy and get people underserved, unbanked. I think there's still a huge kind of I don't want to position it as an opportunity because I don't want to be seen kind of capitalistic or opportunistic.
Responsibility, perhaps.
Yeah. There's a responsibility in the market to kind of look after people too, right? Who are less fortunate.
Yeah. I think that's a good note to finish on. So I guess any final thoughts from you? Where can we find out a bit more about B, a bit more about you?
Thanks. So you can look on our website, beshapingthefuture.co.uk. I'm on LinkedIn. If anyone wants to reach out, feel free.
Amazing. Thanks very much for your time. And we look forward to catching up face to face soon.
Likewise. Good stuff. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, buddy.